In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Hey, we're back here. It's Downtown 523. Time to talk movies. Pass the Popcorn. Alan Adams of The Main Edge joining us. Hello there, Alan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. A good Monday to you.
And to you as well. Hey, listen, before we talk about any of this other stuff, there is one thing that I have to tell you about this weekend. Sheridan has been going through some of her old papers and stuff, straightening out her studio. And she comes down, I'm working, she comes down and hands me this sort of glossy looking thing. And I can't really tell what it is. And she's like, you should really look at that. And Rich, she pulled out of a box that she's been toting around for some 20 years, a glossy program from the Maine Shakespeare Festival in the year 2000.
Oh my word. Wow.
Yeah. It's got our good friend Eric Gretton on the cover as when he was playing Hamlet, sitting alongside our good friend Sharon Zolper. The pictures are all in here. It is just, it is a trip down
memory lane. Wow. I'm trying to think back. What were the other shows that year?
It was Hamlet. It was Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And it was Comedy of Errors. And
okay.
The kids show was Charlotte's Web.
Okay. I did Comedy of Errors and Charlotte's Web.
Yes. And that was, we won't talk about it. I wasn't involved that year, but we won't talk about those circumstances.
Oh, okay.
It was really just a trip to kind of look through and see a lot of names and faces that I hadn't thought about, like some folks who are still around for sure, but a lot of names that I haven't thought about in a very long time.
Oh, that's awesome! What a great find! I love that.
Right, just out of nowhere. Just what such a trip, you know? And that's 10 years before she and I met.
A little omen there, to say the least. There was something,
yeah. Right?
Right. The powers that be were working on things even before you knew it was happening. Well,
that's
we got
right.
some movies
right.
to talk about, but first, I know you want to weigh in a little bit on the Golden Globes. For me, I think it was summed up best by Tina Fey, and I didn't watch much of it. I just saw the clip when Tina Fey said, "Couldn't have this all been done in an email?" And I thought, "Yes,
yeah." Like, and don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, they a genuine effort was put forth to make a show happen. And in some respects, it was kind of nice. The big one for me was seeing the wide variance in, because once you're allowing people to do it from their homes, there's an extreme variance with regards to how people are going to treat it. From the folks who are in spotless rooms wearing bespoke ball gowns and whatnot. To a friend of downtown, Jeff Daniels, looking like he's basically sitting in his basement.
Yeah, and did you see his tweet about it?
I did.
People were calling him out on on what he was wearing, but he had a great response. He said, "Congratulations to Mark Ruffalo, and a special thanks to the Golden Globes for allowing me to fulfill a lifelong dream of going to an award show wearing Carhartt."
Ah, oh, so good. So good. And then, the whole thing with Jason Sudeikis in his tie-dyed sweatshirt and maybe under the influence a little bit.
Maybe.
Like, speculation going on. He clearly, I don't know if he didn't expect to win or if he just misplaced his speech, left it in the Dorito bag or whatever. But yeah, he was in a weird place. But yeah, like, as for the most part, the awards themselves, there were a few surprises. I did pretty well with my predictions. The only place that I had apparently a blind spot, I didn't get a single actress winner in the movie side. Right. I didn't get a single one of those right because I whiffed on Carey Mulligan, Andra Day, which we'll talk about her in a little bit because I finally got a chance to see the United States versus Billie Holiday. Andra Day won for drama. And then I could have sworn Maria Bakalova was going to win for Borat's subsequent movie film. Like, that was probably the easiest bet of the night as far as I was concerned. And so to see her lose to Rosamund Pike, who again was great, but I just didn't. And then Jodie Foster, of all things, winning for actress in a supporting role, like that feels a little bit like Hollywood Foreign Press shenanigans. But seeing her accept the award while sitting on her couch in her pajamas with her wife and their dog was a hoot. Particularly when she shouted out Aaron Rodgers at the end, because that's fantastic. But like you said, like I mean, this whole award show probably could have been an email, but you know, for folks like me who sort of who dig it when the award shows get a little weird and a little wonky, I had a perfectly lovely time.
Excellent. All right, let's talk movies. You saw three. Where would you like to begin?
Let's start with Tom and Jerry, because look, you know, the history of cinema is just packed with esteemed comic duos. You know, your Abbott and Costello's, your Laurel and Hardy's, your Martin and Lewis's, you know, and so and Tom and Jerry is that kind of pairing. And what I mean by that is, like, there are very few people with any sort of awareness of popular culture and of any age who don't know who Tom and Jerry are. You know what I mean? Like there's an omnipresence to the characters, you know, because they've been around since they made their debut in 1940, I think. So they've been around for 80 some years. That being said, they've always thrived in the sort of 4 to 7 minute, you know, short range,
right?
And so the idea of putting of turning this, you know, this dynamic into a feature film, not entirely sure how the, I wasn't sure how that was going to work. And how it worked was basically turning them into almost supporting characters in their own movie. Like the way is like the dynamic between them remains pretty much intact, and it still largely works. But the truth is that the sort of just the basic nature of those interactions just can't be sustained for 100 minutes. And so you've got a whole different sort of plot revolving involving all of the human actors in the film, because we've got this live action animated hybrid thing happening, and it doesn't always work. Don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, I think it's I think kids are going to dig it. Though they might want a little bit more of the cat and mouse action. And the parents out there, particularly parents who do have fond memories of these characters, will find some things to like as well. Like, again, not necessarily a spectacular success, but far from terrible. The basic gist is Tom has a dream. Like, his dream is to play piano with John Legend. Like, that's legitimately a thing that happens. His dream is to play with John Legend. And so he busks in Central Park in hopes of being discovered. Jerry, meantime, is looking for a new place to live. He encounters Tom, and the usual hijinks ensue. As a result of this interaction, Tom winds up crashing into a young woman named Kayla, played by Chloe Grace Moritz, who winds up losing her gig job because of it, which indirectly leads her to the Royal Gate Hotel. Which then leads, you know, a shenanigan here, a shenanigan there. Next thing you know, she's in the office of the hotel's head honcho, Mr. DuBrose, played by Rob Delaney, who immediately takes a shine to her, although the events manager of the hotel, a guy named Terrence, played by Michael Pena, immediately has suspicions. And there's no room for error, Rich, because the Royal Gate is scheduled to play host to the wedding of the year between Ben, played by Colin Jost, and Preeta, played by Pallavi Sharda. Like, everything has to be just so. So when Jerry decides he's going to live at the Royal Gate, he becomes a problem. And that problem is Kayla's to solve. Her solution, hold on, she brings in Tom to catch Jerry.
Oh,
and get rid of him.
Oh,
from
the I gotcha.
And then, again, just hijinks upon hijinks, you know, threatens to upend the entire event. And, you know, and we're left with all these people dealing with not only the consequences of their own actions, but the actions of a tiny animated mouse. Look, for a movie titled Tom and Jerry, there's maybe not as much Tom or Jerry as you might expect, but it's those characters have never been about narrative. And so, like, look, there are those of us who would be perfectly content to watch 100 minutes of animated anarchy. Like, I'm like, I'll raise my hand. Like, that is something that I would enjoy. But if you're looking to tell a feature-length story, they need help. And again, the set pieces are great. Like, the real zaniness that made Tom and Jerry such so beloved in the first place. The filmmakers have done really good work in sort of integrating the 2D animated characters. Like, it's and there's more than just the titular characters. I won't spoil anything else. Into that sort of three-dimensional world of the movie. Like, we get some chase scenes, which Tom and Jerry has always been great at, and some wonderful sort of Rube Goldberg trap situations, also another thing that Tom and Jerry have been so great at. And they are the most fun part of the movie. I will say there are a couple of pretty unsubtle winks and nods to the grown-ups in the audience, usually sort of revolving around other Warner Brothers properties. And I laughed. And granted, a lot of times I was laughing because it was a little on the nose, but still made me laugh. As far as the non-animated portions, it's fine. Like, it's nobody's fault. Like, everybody's like going for it, and they're doing their best to push the story forward while embracing just the weirdness of performing in this kind of hybrid work. Just the story's not that interesting. Chloe Grace Moritz is fine. Rob Delaney has some nice sort of understated moments. Colin Jost is literally the same as Colin Jost always is. It works here better here than it does in other places. Couple of other interesting sort of almost like cameos. Ken Jeong is here for a couple of scenes. But Michael Pena. Now, I was really pleased to see what Michael Pena did in this movie, because, Rich, there's literally no reason for him to go as hard as he does in this movie. Like, he could have coasted with no problem. But instead, like, he really gets it, and he's, like, the ideal heavy for this kind of movie. Like, he really digs in and lets rip. Like, he has a couple of bits, like, whether he's reacting to, like, animated animal poop, or he's frantically trying to explain to his boss what happened to him in the quote-unquote animal tornado, which was a hilarious line. Like, he's just that right brand of sort of self-involved and incompetent to be the main bad guy for this kind of family film. But anyway, like I said, not a great movie, but it's not trying to be. It's simple, it's fun, just wants to give your kids a good time. And in that respect, it's pretty successful. I mean, I had a good time, and maybe you will too.
All right, what's up next?
Let's talk about the United States versus Billie Holiday, starring newly minted Golden Globe winner Andra Day. Playing an icon on screen is a tricky proposition. Like, it's one of the fundamental challenges that come with making, like, this sort of biopic. It's like, how do you invoke the spirit and sensibility of a famous figure while still avoiding caricature? We've had a couple of these in recent weeks, and we've talked about this a bunch. The idea of avoiding impression or impersonation, but, you know, sort of developing an honest appraisal of the person being portrayed built on actual character, as opposed to, like, just plucking a few, like, you know, prime characteristics and just leaning into those. And sometimes what happens is the skill and subtlety of the central performance greatly outshines the rest of the movie. The movie becomes less about the story and more about the person to whom that story is happening. That's not an indication. It doesn't mean that the film is bad necessarily. Just maybe that it doesn't quite live up to the actor at its center, and that's really the case here. The film is directed by Lee Daniels. The screenplay is written by Susan Laurie Parks, who adapted it from part of a book called Chasing the Scream: The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. This film, it's got a lot of issues. Like, the tone is inconsistent. The direction is uneven. The narrative wanders a little bit, and there are some kind of strange aesthetic choices. But the reality is, like, you can forgive so many of this movie's sins because Andra Day is so good as Billie Holiday. Like, even during the stretches when the movie isn't really working, like, she never stops working. Like, she is magnetic. Like, just incredible to watch, has a beautiful voice, and really sort of evokes Billie Holiday without doing, like, Billie Holiday karaoke. If that makes sense. Like,
yeah.
It's a really like it's a performance that kind of papers over a lot of the film's concerns just through the sheer power of her performance. The story itself, Billie Holiday's already a star when the movie begins. Like, she's one of the most popular jazz singers in the country. People of all colors and creeds are coming together to enjoy her devil-may-care attitude and her just unworldly vocals. But she's got demons. Like, she has a tendency to gravitate towards unhealthy relationships with men who exploit and abuse her. And she's an addict. She's a heroin addict. And her struggles with the drug are kind of an open secret in the music world, and as it turns out, beyond that. So the federal government is not a fan of Ms. Holiday. Specifically, they very much want her to stop singing the song Strange Fruit, which, for those who are unaware, it's this beautiful and haunting song that basically serves this very poetic protest against the, at the time, completely unfettered lynchings of Black Americans that were happening all across the South, even, you know, into the 1930s. The feds believe that the song's too inflammatory, that it's inciting, people to have the wrong attitude. Like, it's just some very unsubtle racism at work during these sections. But they don't believe there's any way for them to punish her simply for singing. But they can punish her for her drug crimes. And that's the plan that's set into motion, led by Harry Anslinger, who's played by Garrett Hedlund here, who heads up the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And he's prepared to do whatever it takes to take down Billie Holiday. And that includes enlisting a vet named Jimmy Fletcher, played by Trevante Rhodes, to go undercover and go after her. Like, he works his way in to her sort of circle, even as her crew expresses their misgivings. But, you know, he winds up fulfilling his duty, and she's arrested. And what follows is basically a decade of harassment and antagonism as Anslinger and his goons do anything and everything within their power, legal and otherwise, to destroy her. Like, the bias and the sheer unfairness of it all actually does get to Jimmy Fletcher, who winds up defying the higher-ups, even as he sort of moves forward with his assignment. So she's just doing what she does best, sing. But she's descending into her own struggles, her issues with her relationships, unsure of who she can trust, and seeking solace in drugs. But, you know, in mid-century America, no matter how talented or famous she becomes, to so many of these people, she's never going to be more than just another Black woman. And it's someone that the government just continues to relentlessly pursue. Now, this movie, it's an interesting case because there's a sort of almost a paint-by-numbers sense to a lot of it. Like almost like a live-action Wikipedia article. Like, it's all very straightforward and just sort of note by, you know, A to B to C. But in there's some odd, like, stylistic flourishes, courtesy of Lee Daniels. You know, not all of which work well, and a couple that just straight-up fail, like, that are just, like, weird and off-putting and just don't work. Like, some weird representational stuff. And it seems like whenever he had any sort of doubts, he would throw in a performance sequence. You know, the conflicting vibes never really coalesce, so they're just, the movie, it has some really engaging stretches, but it doesn't necessarily always click. But like I said, when Andra Day is on screen, man, like, a lot of that just stops mattering. Like, she's, you know, this is her first movie. Like, that's the thing that blows my mind. Like, this is, I mean, she's a very talented singer. Like, she's had some hits over the past, you know, few years, but this is her feature debut. And I think that benefits her, especially in this kind of movie, because she is a relative unknown, at least in terms of, like, experiencing her in this fashion. Like, we don't know her in the context of other movies, so it's easier for us to just completely embrace her as Billie Holiday. That said, it's really tough to dispute just the pure power and the raw presence that she brings to the table. And when you're playing an icon like Billie Holiday, like, that's what you got to do. Like, there's a lot of pressure there, and it sure seems like she bears it up with relative ease. And again, like, I can't, the music is just, like, I mean, just enchanting, like, just a beautiful music. The rest of the cast, they're fine. They do okay. Like, Trevante Rhodes is fine. You know, there are a couple of interesting cameos. Natasha Lyonne shows up for a couple of really good scenes, playing Tallulah Bankhead. Leslie Jordan shows up as a radio interviewer in a bit that's kind of a framing device. Then you've got Garrett Hedlund, who doesn't really seem to know what he should be doing or how he should be doing it. Like, being the bad guy in a movie like this is always tough, but he never really manages to do much other than sort of look around kind of confused. This movie, it just can't reach the heights achieved by its star. But even with the issues that it has, that central performance really makes it a movie that I think is worth seeing.
Excellent. All right, then, we only got a couple of minutes left for Minari. Hope you can encapsulate it all in that time.
I think I can manage. this is a movie. It's funny because award season is going to see a number of these. But this is a movie, much like Nomadland and some of the others, that is very much about the American dream. Like, it's the story of the Yee family moving. They've just moved to Arkansas. It's in the 1980s. Patriarch Jacob, played wonderfully by Steven Yeun. They've moved there. He wants to become a farmer. Specifically, he wants to grow Korean vegetables to both celebrate and profit from his heritage. He brings his family, his wife Monica, played by Yeri Han, and his kids, Anne and David, played by Noel Kate Cho and Alan Kim, respectively, both in their first ever movies. And they basically set up shop and try to make a go of it as farmers in Arkansas. Like, they work as chicken sexers, the same job they had in California, to kind of keep themselves afloat while they're making the farm happen. Jacob hires on this guy, Paul, played wonderfully. Oh, Will Patton is so good in this movie, as a sort of like a full-on, like, tongue-speaking Christian zealot. And the family kind of slowly integrates into town life. They're going to church, making friends. And then they bring Monica's mother, Sunya, to live with them. Dynamics get complicated. Space is at a premium. Sunya moves into David's room. He doesn't know how to relate to his grandmother. You know, she's not like any other grandmother he has knowledge of. She swears and gambles, watches pro wrestling. And, you know, the tension builds as frustrations with regard to the struggles of the farm start to grow and grow. It's a tough task, and it's frustrating. And those frustrations start to boil over, contributing to tensions. And then, you know, some tragedies arise, farm-related and familial alike. And as those troubles mount, we have to wonder just how strong their relationships are going to be and if they're strong enough to help the family weather the difficulties ahead. I thought this was going to be a movie about the racial and social ramifications of a Korean family moving to 1980s Arkansas. Like, I really believed that was what this movie was going to be. There's very little of that. It's not what I expected at all. I wasn't ready for, I wasn't ready for them to be faced by the external struggles that didn't necessarily, they were accepted by the community and things like that. Their cultural and racial differences, they're not ignored, but they're not the thematic foundation of the film. And I'm really glad about that, because it's really just a very sweet, very heartfelt, very complex family drama, one that I think really lays bare this idea of what the American dream even means and what the American immigrant experience is. And to see that sort of play out in this context, it's just an absolutely wonderful movie. I know they won Best Foreign Language Film at the Golden Globes last night. Well-deserved, although it's weird because it is an American film. But it will be very interesting to see what kind of attention this movie gets going forward, because there are a number of performances that warrant attention, and the movie itself, I think, is going to warrant some significant attention. It's a brilliantly conceived film, wonderfully made, and you'll wipe away a tear or two over the course of watching this film, for sure.
Excellent. Hey, thanks, Al. Appreciate it, as always, and we'll visit with you again come Wednesday.
Sounds good.
Alan Adams, Pass the Popcorn, here on Downtown.